Listener supported. WNYC Studios.
Jack Kennedy was a friend of mine. Senator, you're no Jack Kennedy.
I'm sorry, could I just pause? Did I understand you to say, sir, that the Russians are not using Eastern Europe as their own sphere of influence and
occupying? Let me just say, first of all, that I almost resent, Vice President Bush, your patronizing attitude that you have to teach me.
I've had a record of appointing judges in the state of Texas. That's what a governor gets to do.
I don't think I'm that bad.
You're likable enough.
Thank you, sir.
There you go again.
Well, if your name is Mitt or Newt or Rick, you might want to take notes during this next conversation. PBS NewsHour anchor Jim Lehrer, no relation, is here with his new book about presidential debates called Tension City. Jim, always great to have you on the show. Welcome back.
Hey, thanks, Brian. Great to see you again.
We have come a long way from the freewheeling Lincoln-Douglas debates on slavery in the 1850s to this on Monday night.
I obviously will be the moderator. I'll ask questions and follow-ups, and I'll work to try my best to make sure that each candidate is getting his or her fair share of the questions and the answer time. Each candidate will have about 1 minute to answer questions and 30 seconds for follow-ups and rebuttals. Now that the candidates are all in place, it's time for the candidates to introduce themselves to our audience. I'm asking them all to keep it very, very short. Here's an example of what I have in mind. I'm Wolf Blitzer, and I'm usually in the Situation Room, but tonight I'm thrilled to be at the Tea Party Republican presidential debate.
I'm Brian Lehrer, and I'm usually hosting on WNYC at this time of day, as I am today, with my colleague in the business, though no relation, though nobody ever believes that we're no relation,
right.
Jim Lehrer. Can we even call today's events debates as opposed to the soundbite Olympics or something when we hear setups like that?
Well, everybody, it all depends on what you mean by debate. You know, debate has become a generic term for covers an awful lot of things. Even Lincoln Douglas, you know, Lincoln Douglas, the opening statement was those opening statements were an hour and a half each.
Wow.
And then each of them had an hour rebuttal. They were not free flowing debates by any stretch of the imagination.
They were long speeches.
They were long,
followed by long speeches.
Long speeches. And
in the attention span era.
Exactly. And some folks who went to particular high schools and were interested, they have a particular, they when they hear the word debate, they think of one thing. And I see debates as anything where candidates are on the same stage at the same time talking about something. The format is less important than the fact that they're there.
You mention in the book that the Lincoln-Douglas debates did have negotiated rules, as the debates do today, negotiated through the mail. Do you happen to know the rules?
The rules were they were dominated by Lincoln. The two newspaper men who set up the debate were Lincoln people, and so they were all skewered in a way that would help Lincoln more than Douglas. And Lincoln was an orator, they insisted on the format that ended up being there. And it's the same thing today as it was back then.
Those debates had no moderators. How did they do without us?
I know. It's impossible. It's hard to imagine, isn't it? Yeah.
And I guess they didn't take any questions via Twitter.
No.
I want to play a moment of the Obama-McCain debate that you moderated in 2008, and you bring this up in the book, particularly to illustrate one of the ways that you try to get people to talk directly to each other in the debate and to engage and not just give these 60-second sound bites followed by 30-second sound bite rebuttals.
A healthcare system that is broken, energy policies that are not working, because 10 days ago, John said that the fundamentals of the economy are sound.
Say it directly to him.
I do not think that they are.
Say it directly to him.
Well, John, 10 days ago, you said that the fundamentals of the economy are sound. And
be afraid I couldn't hear him?
No, I'm just determined to get you all to talk to each other. I'm going to try.
Take us behind the scenes of that moment.
Well, the problem here was that, not the problem, the fact was that they had the candidates, representatives, in negotiations with the debate commission, had for the first time put in the rules that the candidates could not only direct comments to each other, they could ask each other questions. And I was determined to see if I could make that happen. And everybody knew that's what was going to what was permitted. But for some reason, McCain didn't want to play. And so right there in front of everybody, he wouldn't even look at Obama. Much he wouldn't call him John, he wouldn't call him Barack. Obama called him John, and Obama did everything he could he did everything I asked. And I hung in there to a point that I finally kind of made a jerk of myself, you know, trying to, and I finally gave up.
Well, I didn't think so, but you write in the book how you thought you became the butt of jokes as a result of that, of pressing in that way, the way you did. But do you think that something is to be gained by that, that the viewers would get something different by seeing the candidates look each other in the eye if they actually ever had done it? And engage like that, which I think was the spirit of that rule.
Absolutely, that was what it was about. That the questions that you could literally, John McCain could literally ask Barack Obama a question or follow up on another question, and it would be more of an exchange of the between them rather than through a moderator. And that's what everybody had in mind. That's what the intention was. That's certainly what my intention was. And the simple fact is, and this has nothing to do with the politics. This is not a political commentary by me, but McCain's declining to do that hurt him,
mm-hmm.
because he was perceived as being that he dissed. Disrespected Obama, that he was uptight, nervous. And,
patronizing.
And, yeah, and it hurt him. And here again, it was body language rather than spoken language.
And so our policy wonk audience may be surprised to hear, following up on that, you wrote in the book, at Oxford, Obama's and McCain's differences – this is that debate — on the financial crisis, Iraq, terrorism at all, were props for the main event, Cool versus Edge. Edge, McCain, Cool, Obama, Cool won. For Kennedy, Nixon, and Mondale, Reagan, the comparative issue was charm, while human emotions were central to Dukakis, Bush. Bush won, as was general likability to other encounters, most specifically Bush 2 against both Gore and Kerry. So you mean it's about these fuzzy kinds of things more than who's got the better idea about how to wage the war on terrorism?
It's about both. But by the time you get to these debates, and we're talking late September, early October, the substance issues have been thoroughly, over a period of a year or 18 months, whatever, been thoroughly aired. And for the most part, 90% of the folks have already made up their minds on those substance issues. I like Billy Bob because of his position on Social Security. I don't like Sammy Sue because of his position on whatever. And so what the debates serve for the most of the people. Now, there are some who are coming to this cold, and mm-hmm. so substance is all important to them. But the overwhelming majority, the folks who watch these debates, and there are millions and millions of people, 90, 100 million people sometimes watch them, they are there to take a measure of the folk, of the people, of the candidates. Can I imagine somebody sitting behind a desk in the Oval Office as President of the United States, this person as compared to that person, and there they are. Do I like this person? All those kinds of things.
Likeability, where Bush scored higher than either Gore or Kerry.
That's right.
Although I think John Stewart, you were on John Stewart last night, right?
Yeah.
I think it was John Stewart who had that great line after the fact, who said, why would you base your vote on whether you'd rather have a beer with somebody who's a recovering alcoholic? But we'll leave that aside.
Yeah, right. Good point. But it's just the fact of the animal, these presidential debates. I mean, it is a... It is that only opportunity, the only opportunity in the course of a presidential campaign where you get to see the two candidates side by side.
And here's another one of those likability moments that many of our listeners will remember.
Well, that hurts my feelings.
I'm sorry, Senator. I'm sorry.
but I'll try to go on. He's very likable. I agree with that. I don't think I'm that bad.
You're likable enough.
Thank you so much. I appreciate that.
Now, we didn't have the original question there, which I guess was reflected on how she was perceived as not likable or however it was actually phrased.
Exactly.
And I think that moment went against Obama because he was seen as patronizing when he said, you're likable enough.
You're likable enough. Yeah, I agree with you. I agree. But you see, that's it also points up, you know, just how fraught with risk these things are. You could just make a casual comment that you would like. You might, if you're somebody, if you're just standing there talking, and you realize everything you say in a presidential debate is fodder for something, for somebody.
Listeners, you want to talk to Jim Lehrer? Rare opportunity to talk to the legendary anchor of the News Hour with Jim Lehrer, as it was long known, on PBS, 212-433-WNYC. You can talk about presidential debates. You can ask Jim Lehrer anything about it. You're game for this, right?
Absolutely.
Anything about his career in journalism or behind the scenes at the NewsHour? What are Brooks and Shields really like? I don't know. 212-433-WNYC, 212-433-9692, or post your comment or question to WNYC.org. Click on Brian Lehrer Show. His brand new book, his first nonfiction book. Do you read Jim Lehrer's novels? Good novelist. his first nonfiction book in more than 20 years is called Tension City. And by the way, Jim will be at the Barnes & Noble in Union Square tonight, East 17th Street, to be precise, kind of on the edge of Union Square, 7 o'clock, in conversation with John Meacham, the Pulitzer Prize-winning author and former Newsweek editor. You're going to be all conversed out by the end of today.
Well, no. I have many more things to say.
Gary in Queens, you're on WNYC with Jim Lehrer. Hello.
Thank you, Brian. One of the things I think is a dumbing down of the debates is when they say, okay, you got 30 seconds, go. You got 30 seconds, go. You got to answer in 30 seconds or whatever. Here's my idea. Get rid of the moderator. No offense, Jim. The next thing you do is, let's say you have two candidates and an hour to debate. You give each candidate 30 minutes to talk. You throw out one issue. One candidate takes 5 minutes. Another candidate just needs 2 minutes to discuss it. You keep going one after another. At the end of the debate, if one guy used up too much, if he was too verbose and he was wasting all his words at the beginning, he loses out, and the other guy is going to be talking more.
It's like a chess clock. Yeah. You ever play chess, Jim? You know how they have chess clocks, right? So each player gets a certain total amount of time, and they can spend however many seconds they want on each particular move. But I don't know. It's an interesting idea. You know, why do they need us at all? That would make them talk to each other, as you tried so hard to do with McCain and Obama. But they always had the fallback of addressing you.
Yeah. The problem with it, I think it's, you know, it'd be an interesting thing to try. The problem is no candidate will ever agree to it because it's too risky. At least in this current world, they probably would not. And it would be extremely difficult to self-enforce rules of how you're going to shut somebody up. There'd be a lot of – it would just be hard. But it I think it's worth a try. And maybe someday when you it'll never be tried at the presidential level because no candidate would ever agree to that. It's all about risk. And as I said earlier, you just make a casual comment. Well, just say if it was wide open like that, the opportunities to say stupid things that you didn't really mean and try to put them back in your mouth would be horrendous, I would think. But I'm all for trying everything. But I just don't think it'll probably ever happen.
The moderator is also there to call people out. I mean, I guess the two of them could call each other out, but one of the problems with this short 60-second answer, 30-second rebuttal, if it's too strictly enforced, is that the moderator doesn't have a chance to follow up and be what I think he or she is really there to be, which is a journalist, and play fact cop. And, you know, also if people are trying to be vague, to pin them down to give a real answer.
up to a point. The journalist function of a moderator is there at the beginning, and there are times, but eventually you have to remember why you're there. It isn't to press somebody. Uh-huh. It is to it's to facilitate an exchange among the candidates, and it is different. And not all great journalists are great moderators. It's a special skill, learned skill.
And here's a one of the most famous debate moments of the last, I guess, 40 years, where I guess the moderator kind of gave former President Gerald Ford a chance for a do-over.
There is no Soviet domination of Eastern Europe, and there never will be under a Ford administration.
Did I understand you to say, sir, that the Russians are not using Eastern Europe as their own sphere of influence and occupying most of the countries there and making sure with their troops that it's a communist zone?
I don't believe, Mr. Frankel, that the Yugoslavians consider themselves dominated by the Soviet Union. I don't believe that the Romanians consider themselves dominated by the Soviet Union.
Max Frankel, former New York Times executive editor, a sometimes listener, so I don't know if he would have objected to my characterizing this as giving Ford a chance to do it again, or more as pressing in on him about an obvious gaffe.
I think he was pressing in. I think he was highlighting the fact, hey, are you really mean this outrageous thing? I mean, that's essentially what he was asking in a very polite, professional way.
But Ford did have the opportunity then to say, oh, no. Well, I didn't really mean it that way. Or, no, obviously I misspoke. But, of course,
And I talked to Ford about it afterward.
Yes.
And he said that he if he just added one or two sentences, he would have been okay. And he conceded that he made a terrible mistake.
Mark in Maplewood, you're on WNYC with Jim Lehrer. Hi.
Thank you very much, and thank you for being on, Mr. Lehrer.
Sure.
I recall a book you wrote called The Last Debate was maybe 15 or more years ago about a debate moderator and the questioners who had potentially or had colluded to make one candidate possibly look bad. And I was wondering, in your studies, whether historical or currently or in any way, you have any thoughts on what either is the potential for that to still happen or the potential for that to have actually happened in the past.
Jim, this is your dream caller. This is a listener in New Jersey who calls up and makes a reference to a novel that you wrote 15 years ago.
This is, and I'm not related
to
him.
To frame a contemporary
question.
And his
last name isn't Lara either.
We don't know that.
Oh, yes. Well, to answer your question, I thought that it was fiction. The point I was trying to make, if I was trying to make a point, and I would make it now, is that this is all dynamite handling. Whether it's a sole moderator format or it's a format with the old-fashioned way with a moderator and three panelists, you're dealing with the dynamite of a presidential election. You can, by the way you conduct yourself, either through word or deed, you can affect not only the outcome of the debate, but you can affect the outcome of the election. And it is true today as it was when I wrote that novel 15 years ago. In fact, in some ways, it's even more fraught with risk when you have most of these debates now are sole moderator debates. Mm-hmm. That means one person sitting there.
Right.
And that person makes up those questions, doesn't clear them with anybody,
really?
And certainly doesn't clear them with anybody in either campaign or whatever. It is up to him or her to decide what is asked,
right,
what is followed up on.
So we do, having done some of those, as you have on the national level, we do them with, staffs and teams coming up with those questions.
Exactly.
Editors.
But eventually, you have to make the decision yourself. And I always cut off the staff about 5 days before every debate because I don't want people to have to lie about, is Billy Bob going to ask this and, all that stuff. Because intelligence would be everything. If a candidate knew ahead of time that a certain question was going to be asked, it would be terrific.
Paying a low-paid desk assistant under the table for
you got
the
it.
Questions
you
in
got
advance.
It.
Brian in Brooklyn, you're on WNYC with Jim Lehrer. Hello.
Hi. I'm excited to be talking to both of you. I'm a young journalist, a TV news producer who's always known that's what I wanted to do, and I watch TV news, including Mr. Lehrer, from the time I was a kid. So I'm interested in finding out, with all the internet stuff aside, where you think the future of TV news specifically is going, since we sort of have this news hour model versus a local nightly news model in like your community and the whole 24-hour cycle. So I wanted to know how you think we can keep television news specifically viable to get viewers and make a little cash as well.
I think the future for TV news is unlimited. I think it's a growth industry as long as everybody who's in the business and the people, young people who are interested in coming, or even old people who are interested in coming into it, realize that it isn't just TV news. The News Hour, for instance, yes, it's an appointment television program, but that's only one of the things it is now. It is, we are there 24 hours a day as a website. We have all kinds of links to other partners, to other news organizations. We are all, those of us who are in the serious news business, and I emphasize the word serious, those of us who are in the serious news business, whether we're in print, whether it's radio, blogs, other things on the internet or television, we're all in this together. And I see the News Hour, for instance, as a serious news organization with many, many platforms, to use the current term. We're now no longer just an appointment television program. You can watch the News Hour any time of day or night on all kinds of little, your
iPad app.
iPad with your name engraved can be pink and your name can be engraved on it, and you can watch the News Hour.
Shields and Brooks by itself is broken out as a popular podcast.
Absolutely right. And that is not only the future, that is the present. And the future, we don't even know what the future is going to be, but it's going to require television-type news coverage. In other words, somebody with a camera. Somebody with a microphone, and it's just going. The outlets are the ones that are growing. The need for the television news coverage is there, and it's going to grow.
What's your status on the News Hour now? Are you completely retired?
Not completely. I still do Shields and Brooks on Friday. I'm still the executive editor of the program, and I have fingers here and there, and I'm on a glide path, and I'm gliding.
How long did you do that show?
We started in 1975 with a 30-minute McNeil. Well, it was Robert McNeil Report, and then the McNeil Lehrer Report, and then the News Hour in '83.
And started as a half-hour night on one issue.
That's right, one story a night for 30 minutes.
Do you miss that, or do you think there's a hole, in our serious television journalism without a format like that?
I think there is. I think you could do both. I mean, when we went to the News Hour, we changed our whole thing, our whole concept. The concept before, our reason for being was watch a nightly news program and then come to us for one story in depth. And now the News Hour, we say, hey, you don't have to watch anybody else, just us. But I think the idea of saying, okay, we're going to do the top story a day for 30 minutes, one in one of these many, many multi-platform formats, I think would be a terrific thing to do.
We have 30 seconds left. Can you handle a top three, top two, top one memorable moments question from 36 years? What's the first story you tell, if you had to tell a story?
I missed a time cue with President George H.W. Bush, and I interrupted him in the middle of his question, of his answer, and I said, Mr. President, time's up. And he said, no, I still got more time. And I said, oh, I'm wrong, sir, I'm sorry. Go ahead. And he said, I forgot what I was saying.
Did you think the younger George Bush was wearing a wire in that other
debate? No, I know he wasn't.
And there we leave it with Jim Lehrer, legendary anchor and executive editor of the News Hour on PBS. It's always great to see you. Thank you very much.
Hey, my pleasure, Brian.
The new book is called Tension City, which is all about the history of presidential debates. The phrase is how President George H.W. Bush described to you what a debate is like, right?
That's right.
And Jim Lehrer at Barnes & Noble Union Square tonight at 7. Brian Lehrer on WNYC.